you very much. I want to take you on a journey with through these four steps, and I hope you can follow me. Much is published on identity, to which the Freiburg Archaeological Institute contributed for more than 15 years, and many considerations have been made. With Lutz Niethammer's, I think only in German, published study on collective identity, it became apparent on what problematic sources the widespread use of the term is grounded. The term should not be used too firm, essentialist, and not too weak, constructivist, so that analytically the detailed investigation of identification and categorization, self-understanding and social position, community and connectedness is recommended, as Brubaker wrote. However, the term is likely to promise some analytical gain in reflected use. Its importance lies in the fact that it emphasizes the assertion of identity in the sense of equality of everybody. The appearance shall hide that behind identity, considerable differences exist that are neglected due to certain reasons in specific situations. Identities make attributions and thus social constructions that are nevertheless of some importance and explosiveness. Without them, there is no social cohesion as we know. First, they are individuals who have an identity. This applies in a very direct way because everyone is unique and identical with himself. Beyond this literal use of the term, everybody occupies roles in specific social contexts. He comes from a family defined by kinship, thus prestige or status may be linked. Furthermore, gender and age are important references that co-decide about identities. Integrations of religious nature are included as well as ethnic or regional networks. The diversity reveals how complex identities of individuals not only cannot be, but actually are. It is mainly, I think, a terminological difference if this is described as diverse identities of one individual person or as diverse aspects of identity of this person. I would prefer the first notion. Thus, social groups are addressed. They can only exist if they also possess an identity. The reason is that the actual diversity of the group members must be covered in order to achieve cohesion. In many ways, leaving aside the suggested ascription, there are differences determined by gender, age, family, possessions, or the like. Depending on the context, they are purposefully hidden because the different assignment is in the foreground and makes them appearing as a secondary or tertiary one. Complex overlays are typical. Individuals do not belong only to one group, but to various groups. This leads to problems, but contradictions must be endured because identity overlays cannot be avoided. Which identity is emphasized depends on the current situation. Other assignments are then temporarily subordinated, but can quickly be updated and advanced. Identity can only develop when there are others to which differences are emphasized. It needs the mirror to recognize itself. Analytically, this attribute of the other is called alterity. Only based on this, a group can develop an idea of its own characteristics, which in turn will give the group strength and duration. The classical Greeks became aware of their Hellenism beyond their numerous poleis to which they had previously been associated only in the confrontation with the Persians around 500 BC. The developed image of the Persians, the alterity constructed by the Greeks, hardly correspond to a nuanced view, but represent a black and white colored image of an enemy or of a counterworld, as the Romans did centuries later. In other cases, such as the Roman ethnography of barbarians, the external perspective reveals more about the observer than about the actual conditions in the observed. Internal views and external perception are closely linked, but in a reciprocal relationship. Both are interdependent, and the foreign assignment says little about the actual self-image of the observed, because it does not rely on their own standards, but to those of the observer. The observation can influence their identity, sooner or later due to unequal power relations or to long-term contacts. Identity uses the perception from outside to expose one's own. This perception is based on categorizations, order patterns, and stereotypes. Identity constructions are always determined by the situation in which they arise and are addressed. Individuals are differently depending on the context because it's important to behave properly. Really means that in a specific situation, delineation and mapping must work. In the family context, this is achieved by means other than in the general public, which in turn follows different rules and expectations than in a professional context or at cultural events. The situation also relates to the actions of groups. They can emphasize language or habitus, cultural characteristics, social or religious differences as an opportunity to highlight differences or togetherness. In doing so, somebody is included in one group, and this also means the exclusion of others. Erecting borders has inevitable this double character. Similar to identity and alterity, inclusion and exclusion go hand in hand and are possibly only in combination. Primarily, identity has an integrative effect that enables social cohesion and meets the core needs of social groups. But assignments follow interests. They are not simply present or have unconsciously developed. In this case, they would not possess the importance they have for social groups and identities. They are guided by interests. One pursues goals, and to achieve them, assignments are useful. To belong to a group stronger than others in a given situation gives advantages, access to resources, status, possessions. Therefore, identities are poorly targeted, and they can evolve with changing interests too. This can be generalized. Identities gain importance only if they are expressed and demonstrated. One cannot keep them if they are to gain relevance. Then one has to, again, appropriate and depending on the situation, behave in a way that affiliations and assignments are visible. Then their perception and appreciation decide about success. This could be characterized as performance, if you want to. At the same time, it has to be stated that specific actions, habits, or symbols are crucial where boundaries are drawn and which assignments are emphasized. According to Jürgen Straub of Bochum University, one can imagine identity on a wide scale when it is to achieve the unity of differences, which is the aim of identity. The ends of the scale form extremes that are only theoretically possible, but impossible in social practice and in history. One end would be characterized by complete fragmentation so that cultural and social difference of any kind would not bridge. Such a fragmented society could not exist. Also, theoretically appears the other extreme in which differences are leveled and complete equality achieved. And indeed, it is virtually and historically impossible. Yet identity is not static, stable, and strong. Its place on the abstract scales is mobile. Straub also makes clear that the two scales, both ends, came close to modern social political concepts. Totality, in other words, homogeneity, has matches with totalitarian concepts by expecting impossible equality of all, identity in the strict sense of the word. Fragmentation, on the other hand, would be a condition that would come into existence through laissez-faire, and the lack of even marginal similarities would prevent social cohesion. Straub's approach makes clear that neither concept can work. Identity always requires a central position, as shown here. Also, this place is movable and identity changeable. It decides who belongs to and who the others are. My second point, the early Middle Ages, row grave cemeteries. Merovingian archaeology relies primarily on grave finds, and that makes the wide interest in it. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of graves have been excavated and published. The extensive grave goods form an excellent basis to detect temporal and spatial developments. Typology, we have heard about that, chronology, and find distribution are therefore preferred themes of Central European early medieval archaeology. Row grave cemeteries, as shown on this map, which is nearly 50 years old, are the typical Merovingian period burial sites. they have, from an analytical point of view, four primary and two secondary characteristics. They are firstly inhumation graves, secondly with an east-west, or better, west-east orientation, while women are often buried with clothing or jewelry components, third point, and men with weapons, the fourth point. A more or less line arrangement of the tombs is, contrary to the established name, not necessarily, and only for long-term occupancy, large cemeteries with hundreds of burials developed. These cemeteries appear across northern Gaul to Britain and Pannonia and to the Iberian Peninsula, which is not mapped here. The notion that the row grave cemeteries were established by ancient Germans goes back already to the 19th century. It applies its argument primarily from the notion that such tombs were unusual for Romans. Under this premise, Germans should be distinguished from Romans. A second distinction relates to various Germanic groups that should be identified by their different clothing habit. In this way, tribes and their settlement areas are separated from each other. Cultural historical archaeological studies often were based on typological difference of fibular forms, and their geographical distributions were directly interpreted as ethnic distributions or territories. Two examples may illustrate such approaches. The first example, the separation of Germans and Romans. That means ancient Germans and Romans, and you see it's German text, the German chart, left side is the Germans, the right side, the Romans. Bierbauer, but this page is from Frau Gestein's article, but they go close together. Bierbauer identifies Romans within Frankish settlement regions. This is based on the definition of two cultural models that are presented as ideal types with their genuine characteristics derived from those regions in which Romans had been completely untouched by acculturation phenomena initiated by dominating Germanic groups. Quote Bierbauer. The defining characteristic of the Romans is the regular absence of grave goods established by strict rules as a result of Christianity. So behind this difference, there is in the end, a religious difference, as viewed by Bierbauer. In the 6th and 7th century, the regular absence of grave furnishing was often neglected, but it should not be interpreted as a temporary and partial Frankishness of the Romans, as Bierbauer wrote. In contrast, Germans buried their dead with extensive grave goods. Changes in these two models are considered by Bierbauer as acculturation, as an exclusive approximation of one side to the other, as a significant change, if not abandoning of ethnic identity. Acculturation therefore lead, quote, in the end, in the west of the Frankish territory, to a permanent Romanization of the Franks, and in the east, to a permanent Franconization of the Romans. In fact, Bierbauer looks for religious differences, as I told before. Not only the Roman absence of grave goods is explained with Christian beliefs, but also Germanic grave furnishings are connected with an old pagan afterlife conception. Thus, the tombs are regarded as expressions of religious affiliation, which does not fit quite well on the political situation of the time. The Merovingian Empire was a Christian empire, and the Franks were Christians. Clovis was baptized around 500 AD. The grave furnishing had other, as I think, than religious reasons. And this is an example from Frau Gestein, which shows one cemetery in France, in Lothringen, and there is some apparent changes in grave furnishing. That means that grave furnishings disappear, and Frogenstein interprets this in terms of a Romanization of the Frankish population. I would argue that's just the loss of representation through grave goods during burial. And my second example is Frank Siegmund's cultural models again, but different cultural models. It does not distinguish between ancient Germans and Romans, but between different tribes, mainly Franks and Alemanni. Siegmund's starting point is a frequency of certain grave goods. In essence, he studied statistically the proportions of grave goods,
ceramics and glass vessels on the one hand and weapons on the other. He thinks that the differences are again not only geographically determined, but are referring to ethnic identities. However, the argument is ultimately a geographical one, because contrary to Sigmund's opinion, the differences are not very particularly evident at the frontier. As you can see, this would be the proposed areas and the big symbols symbolizing the Frankishness and Alemannicness of the cemeteries. They are bigger in the centers of these areas, not in the at the frontier zones. Instead, there are diffuse transitions, while in their centers the cultural models appear very typically. This observation leads to another, again, more simple explanation. Communication and exchange may have been the deciding factors that contributed to a regionally varying frequency of these things. For the real throne pottery and glass vessels, there has been a higher proportion in the Rhineland and northern Gaul, because in these regions the production sites were situated. Far away in Alemannia, it was much more difficult and expensive to get these products. For weapons, must be argued otherwise. With them, beyond regional differences in frequencies over time, the same trends can be observed. Constant role of Sparta and lance, disappearance of axes, and increasing number of the sacks. Probably representation and the use of weapons are decisive. What are these studies primarily asking for? They basically and primarily look for the identification of various ethnic groups in the early Middle Ages, or what they think had been ethnic groups in the early Middle Ages. So they aim at determining Merovingian alterities, which are reconstructed due to regional differences of archaeological finds and features. While Bierbauer sees written records of such a group as a general precondition, Sigmund sees archaeological entities as given. Although sometimes the concept of identity is mentioned, the determination of the others is central. So not identity, but alterity. Not the past is interpreted as different to the to our time, but the cultural differences are seen as early medieval foreignness of different groups. Identity, however, is actually present on a different level. The outlined ethnic paradigm presupposes groups inside homogeneous and outward distinct. To postulate them in the early Middle Ages is not only to misunderstand the political rather than cultural nature of ethnic attributions, but also to overestimate the cultural homogenizing power of the politically determined Merovingian kingdoms. Rather, an expectation lays behind it, which results from modern conditions. The ideal of the nation state aiming to linguistic, cultural, and ethnic homogeneity. This ideal, I think, is aimed at linguistic and cultural homogeneity. Differences are its problem because they contradict its goal, and this also implies minority issues and alienation fears in modern states. Without question, there should have been frequent local and regional assignments, but these were usually less absolute and decisive as they are among modern nation-state conditions. But this is projected back into the early Middle Ages as conceptualized as similar. One could also say as identical to the present. So the past is not different, but familiar, and it's measured by our own standards. This is also the basis of the ethnic paradigm, as we heard before, and I changed a little bit the scheme by Susan Hakenbeck, which you see on the upper part of this chart. This ethnic paradigm presupposes homogeneity and consistency of cultural, language, political organization, and physical constitution. When this starting point is set, continuities on the lower part can be tracked up to a supposed origin or ethnogenesis, and vice versa, migrations up to foreigners into a foreign land. This approach can be illustrated on the one hand with a timeline and on the other as a circle or a double circle. Starting from texts, an alleged territory is reconstructed, and this is compared with archaeological distribution maps matches are the basis of, for the assumption of ethnic thimbles, and they serve as an argument for foreigners in case of sporadic occurrence far away. The central premise, however, is a crucial problem. This homogeneity and consistency does not exist. Similar to the construction of identity by the affected people, this analytical view hides the actual complexity of the situation. Differences are immediately considered as ethnic, which at the same time are thought as the most important. After all, there are alternative cultural, economic, social alternatives to the ethnic paradigm that have to be weighed against each other in individual cases. The geographical argument that archaeology likes to endeavor is none. All finds and features have distribution areas, all have distribution areas for very different reasons. To determine the latter remains a challenge, not just to state them. Okay, my third point, looking at the regional occurrence of the Roe grave cemeteries, it's noticeable that they occur almost exclusively within the previous late Roman Empire, from Britain, as you have seen, to Iberia and Pannonia. Two exceptions, the Main area in Thuringia should confirm the picture, both showed intensive contacts with Rome earlier. These are always peripheral regions and not the political centers where local societies buried their dead with grave goods. So far, all attempts have been unsuccessful to identify earlier models in Germania beyond the frontiers. All observations point out that the Roe grave cemeteries represented something culturally new, without older models, either within or outside the empire. The population felt compelled, in view of increasing uncertainty, to emphasize social affiliations and differences at the periphery of the late Roman Empire, and funeral apparently offered the best chance in doing so. These considerations led to an opposite perspective. They consider early medieval societies not primarily from the outside, but try to look inside to understand their structure and functioning. Since the conviction has been weak, tombs were a mirror of real life and reflect social structures directly, there seems to emerge an analytical problem. The performativity of burials means that grave furnishings, as well as the layout of the graves and cemeteries, tell archaeologists something about the ideas of the involved contemporaries rather than directly about social conditions. As such, the lamented disadvantage turns into an advantage to gain access to local identities of early medieval societies. It's helpful to ask for the addressee to whom the representation of social belonging and assignment was directed. Who were the spectators, whose eyes saw the burials, and who were able to see the driven effort? There were no ethnic foreigners, but neighbors and thus the local society who looked at the burials of relatives. In this case, identities due to specific situations does not mean that significant reversals were missing. Rather, the burials should have provided an opportunity to show a comprehensive picture of the dead person and its family. If so, then the reconstruction of identity groups requires careful investigation to achieve plausible results. Some identity groups I will very shortly discuss. First, religion. I mentioned the suggested pagan character of grave goods. Late antique textual evidence does suggest that Christians do not need them in their graves, Augustine and others. But at the same time, Christians bury their dead with grave furnishings, as Augustine and others observed and lamented on it, because it was not a religious statement for them, but an emphasis of social affiliation. Even Christians could perceive dead classing as important afterlife equipment. Michael Müller-Wille saw two religious worlds represented in the tombs of Childeric at Tournai and his son Clovis in Paris, primarily by their place on a burial ground or in a church donated by Clovis himself. Whether they were equipped differently cannot be ascertained, as Clovis' grave has not been found yet. Probably, however, the effort in Clovis' burial was not less than for his father, because the king had to be buried appropriately. The differences may have been in the funeral ritual, which was held differently in the church 30 years later than that in Tournai. In any case, it's primarily the rituals that characterize burials religiously, even if they are archaeologically difficult to grasp. Second, individual identity, if you want to. Each grave contains, apart from multiple burials once, an individual, so it also reflects its individual recognition and ability. Rarely the name, as in this case, of a historical figure can be determined by inscriptions and identified from contemporary texts. Sometimes the identification is problematic, such as for Annegunde from Saint-Denis. Her name ring has triggered the debate about whether she is the wife of King Clothar or not. Although the majority of archaeologists advocates for the identity, doubts remain. An archaeological point would be that the grave probably has to be dated later than the lifetime of Annegunde. And the monogram in the ring cannot only be read as Regine on the right side, which would be unusual since otherwise only names have been abbreviated, but also as a repetition of the name Annegunde. Gender. Even if archaeology sometimes identifies women and men, a bioanthropological analysis is essential. Only on this basis one can judge how gender roles have been marked culturally. For Central European expectations, or let's say West Central European expectations, it's probably surprising that pigtail clasps and earrings occur with Avar men. In the Merovingian West, a number of gender-specific grave goods can be identified. Clothing components and jewelry for girls and women, weapons and belts for men and boys. With them, one can determine which aspects of local societies were important. In addition to grave goods limited to one or the other gender, there were neutral furnishings that have been made for both women and men. These include vessels or furniture and are expected to have demonstrated primarily social affiliations. Fourth, the age. Different social roles can be seen from the fact that grave goods clearly depend on the age of the death. And this is probably due to different roles during one's lifetime. In both genders, the size of the grave goods rises starting with childhood. Well, the number of grave goods rises starting with childhood. Adults and matrons got the maximum before they decrease again in old age. But these differences are very locally determined, so therefore I just show one local example. To examine these different social roles, biological age determinations are required that are far more precise for younger than older individuals, as we know. Fifth point, kindredship, or kinship. On row grave cemeteries, groups of graves suggest some relationships. Not in every case, but some cemeteries show these groups. Since other groups are possible, it requires additional evidence for kinship. They can only partially be provided by anthropological analysis because they provide data only for descent and not for affiliation, which is achieved by marriage between families. More important is this affiliation. Thus, further evidence must be obtained that is deduced from the structure of the grave groups. If the respective areas cannot be attributed to gender, age group, or social group, it's likely to interpret them as kinship organized groups. To differentiate between families based on specific brooches or vessel types, as here, is rather unlikely. They probably reflect fashion phases, such as Sigmund argues for the mid-6th century, based on Thuringian finds. Rank. That extent and quality of grave goods refer to social rank is a plausible assumption. Reliable conclusions can only be reached if sex and age are taken into account, gender and age are taken into account before. Because of gender-specific grave goods, it remains difficult to establish a direct comparison between men and women, as clothing and weapons are difficult in their value to compare. With respect to age-related furnishings, they can be compared only within the same age group, because children and old people are, in most cases, equipped differently than middle-aged adults. Under these conditions, quality groups can be established as proposed by Kristlein 40 years ago. For the large-scale comparison, they still offer a used aid, even if temporal and geographical limitations are obvious. For the reconstruction of local societies and their comparison, one need to look much more in detail. Profession, activity, also professions were invented much later than in the Merovingian times. There are found some equipment and tools among the grave goods that refer to certain economic activities. Especially noteworthy are smith's graves with hammer, anvil, and tongs. Therefore, the deceased are considered generally as smiths. Agricultural implements, as here, an example from southwestern Germany, are surprisingly far more rare. The majority of the population was peasants who were familiar with agriculture and animal husbandry. It must therefore be considered whether a plowshare or coulter means more than just plowing. Perhaps disposal of land? Henning has recently suggested plowshares pointed to a truth test past with glowing blades, although written sources appear much later. And I am very skeptical of this. Overall, the connection of devices and thus the activities carried out is not as clear as often thought when it comes to whether the bird itself actually worked with them. And region? The interpretation of regional clusters and differences remains a challenge because the causes stuck behind the mapping could be explained only by additional arguments, but these can hardly be found. Whether regionally limited presence of certain types of items were relevant for identity or just revealed through communication and exchange is rarely to decide. In addition, archaeological distribution maps reflect wider regions, as you can see here, which go much further than to regional or ethnic identity, apart from elite contacts. They should be expected in smaller regions, but then the archaeological detectable differences become too little to be still visible. Therefore, in most cases, object distributions should be mainly described as communication phenomena. Previously, isotope studies undertaken show a complex picture, which fits well with archaeological considerations pointing in the same direction. Overall, it should be emphasized that conclusions about identities or aspects of identities cannot be drawn directly from grave goods and their combinations, but only indirectly and based on available additional information. Only when they make the context more clear, a step further is methodologically possible. For some aspects, the context succeeds less well for other assignments, as kinship, occupation, region, and for some, perhaps hardly, religion or ethnicity. Complex grave furnishing can reflect complicated relations and networks. These insights are as important and should be expanded. It's likely that further comparisons of different burial sites will allow more clearly to identify what local features represented and what was the trend of the time. However, it applies to all analyses to consider that usually it remains unclear whether a burial ground represents a local community. Several cemeteries may have belonged to a settlement and also vice versa, and from the 5th century on, there was several complementary burial sites, at least in Central Europe, at the Rograve Cemetery or with separate graves within the settlement or at the church, which only together tend to represent a local or small regional society, but are discovered and investigated rarely simultaneously, of course. In addition, it depends on a detailed chronology to achieve more dynamic reconstructions than previously. Well, and my fourth and last point, which is shorter. In comparing the two perspectives, the cultural historical archaeological perspective and the recent identity perspective, their opposite orientation becomes apparent, I think. So, recent studies that look for diverse identities and groups in early medieval societies are increasing. They are interested in contemporary perceptions and possible actions, and that means a look inside. The concept of identity, which is the basis for these studies, has heuristic and analytical value in explaining constitution and action of social groups. Otherness, alterity, is always included in discourses of identity. Both are intertwined. However, identity groups within local societies can be reconstructed more easily because the recipients are tangible, the other gender, age groups, and families in the neighborhood. There we can observe how the local balance between fragmentation and totality, according to Straub, was achieved. Comparing regions with each other, it lacks reference points that can be attributed to different grave goods. And the larger the regions considered are, the less likely it is to link the observable differences with identities and alterities. Even in the early Middle Ages, communication and mobility were expansive and intense, and therefore many distribution patterns of fine categories do not have their reason in identities. Identities constituted political associations which were named by ethnic terms. They were cultural heterogeneous, more at least heterogeneous as modern ideas up to national industries of the migration period suggested for a long time. This is confirmed by textual evidence. The politically defined Frankish Empire was culturally diverse. Identity is the guiding principle for actual approaches, but it has recently been used in other studies too. There it is used to separate early medieval ethnic groups on the basis of grave goods. Such an approach seems to me to invert the meaning of the terms identity and alterity. Today, the early medieval world is different to us, foreign. Before we can reach a historical understanding of this time, it must be analyzed in detail. Actions and habits of the contemporaries can only be explained if one can reconstruct their own social and cultural perception as far as possible. Only then identities can be characterized as well as their importance for social and political action. In this perspective, more comes into view than the political distinction of Franks, Alemanni, Goti, and Lombards, namely numerous situational group identities within local and regional societies. So on a different level, I would say. The cultural image of the past becomes complex, or more complex, and nuanced closer to former realities. In a way, the cultural historical archaeological view is equivalent to ancient ethnographies. Like them, it looks externally to those regions and groups, trying to categorize and order, describe, and explain them. Such a total perspective from outside has fundamental difficulties to understand its object, not in analyzing the object. For instance, to become familiar to the internal perspective. This was not the aim of the observers. They wanted to establish a principal boundary between civilization and barbarism. This inevitably resulted in a dichotomous distinction between Greek democracy and Persian despotism, or between Romans and ancient Germans. Unlike ancient ethnographies, a cultural historical archaeology does not conceive its object as different or as an alternative to its own world. Its interpretation tends to presuppose cultural homogeneous and cohesive groups and to approximate them to the familiar ideal of modern states. Differences or alterities are then provided between gentes, which should have expressed their differences among themselves in dress and habitus, which allow distinguishing different settlement areas. The demarcation of the other becomes a central motive of action in the early Middle Ages. It should have determined the life of the people more than anything else. If one seeks to distinguish between ethnic interpretation and the search for ethnic identity from each other, so on one hand, ethnic interpretation and ethnic identity on different field, as recently Christoph Eger did, one restricts himself to cultural relations beyond ethnicity. So it's a cultural interpretation, not an ethnic one. In fact, it remains the ethnic point of view, because it's argued then ethnically, as the chosen names for clothing, accessories, or grave forms reveal. The result, I would say, is then a contradictio in adjecto. However, this view is based largely on a geographical argument. The spatial occurrence of certain grave goods. Identities, however, are determined by social conditions and perceptions. Ethnic symbols are therefore arbitrary, and space a social construction. This leads to three conclusions, according to space. Region can only play a role as an explanation when its views as socially determined. Secondly, it requires at least the consideration between an ethnic and other different interpretations. And thirdly, far more than ethnicity, which probably played a role in political elites, common identities affected everyday life of the contemporaries much more. Local and small regional identities seem to me more interesting for early medieval archaeology than ethnic alterities. So regional local identities instead of ethnic alterities. The use of scientific analysis of ancient DNA and isotopes will show a more complex situation, providing very interesting new insights instead of answering old questions objectively as sometimes expected. Thank you very much.